And he said, so when I got to LSU, it was such a stimulating experience. I played in the band, in the orchestra, got a chance to do some conducting, did research projects, you know, with some esoteric things about the clarinet, mouthpieces and reeds and stuff. And I had a composition professor, who literally seemed to know everything. I said, man. And I started talking to some guys who had gone to Michigan, and they didn't seem to be getting that. So I said, man, I ain't going to no Michigan.
I carried them all. They were good.
Yeah.
Now, to death, you know.
Now, had Lubinsky sent him to talk to you? Was that?
No, he was on. Lubinsky was too busy fucking people with song royalties and everything. Teddy Reagan and Lubinsky were a great pair. They deserved each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my dear friend Ross Russell, who was very, we're talking about old people in the business now, he was a very nice guy. We called Bird on Dial.
Right. Is he still alive?
He's probably still alive. He's too good-looking and too bright to be dead, I think. he was like a guy that shaped my life,
uh-huh.
My philosophies of life. He was an idol to me. And he was very kind to me, you know. I used to sell a lot of his Bird records and dials in my store. Anytime a Bird would come out, I'd buy 1,078, you know. And I was his biggest customer in the United States. And so he said one day, he calls me. He says, Bob, I'm moving to New York, the company. Do you think it's a good move? I said, yeah, man, it's great. You'll love it here, Ross. You know, the musicians are here. So he says, yeah, okay, I'm moving. So he came, you know, and I got very friendly. And he opened a little office in a store near mine, a block away, on 50th Street. So he had Dial Records there, and I had New Jazz up the block, way to Prestige, you know. And every day I go over there at lunchtime and talk with Ross. And he was a great guy, you know. He was like, he looked like Robert Stack, and he was a pro golfer on the golf tour one time, and he was a writer of detective stories, and he was brilliant with politics. I mean, for a guy my age, I was in early 20s, I guess, I mean, I looked up to the man. He was like my inspiration, you know. He'd tell me all kinds of shit about life and philosophy, and he helped me. He was my company, you know. He was my competitor, but he wasn't, because, see, his attitude was when Savoy and him would fight over Bird, he got fed up. He said, well, there's nobody recording that I don't have Bird. I said, but you got Wardell Gray and you did Dexter and this and that. I said, Ross, you can keep going on, you know. You make good records. You know what you're doing. He said, no, no, there's not Bird. It's no good. So he says, you take Wardell Gray.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do this, do that, and get this, and get James Moody. I put him out, he's okay, you know. He'd tell me what to do. He said, do this, give me your lessons, you know. And I appreciated it. And I said, well, Ross, you know, what are you going to do? He says, well, I'm going to Modern Classics. So he fucked up. He made the wrong choice.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't have Bird, right?
Right.
There was a million other people.
Yeah.
So it's like I jumped over the Bird thing, you know. So he went in the Classics. They were great records, and they bombed, and that was the end of Ross. And I'd see him every 5 years. He'd come in, we'd go to a ball game or something together, and then I'd never see him, and then I'd never hear from him. Now I haven't heard from him for years. And I feel bad because, you know, sometimes when you're a young person and you're influenced, you want to see that person again and talk to him.
Right.
And you wish him well, you know?
Yeah.
It's like when Symphony Sid came back and was on the air in South Florida, I'd go see him. I talked to him on the phone all the time, you know, and his appreciation what he did for my life. He put Prestige over, man, you know.
Yeah.
He played Stan Getz anywhere east of the Mississippi, they heard his show. I'd sell 50,000, 78 like nothing, you know. And he never asked me for anything. So in appreciation, I'd go see him or talk to him, you know.
Right. Let me understand this. When you were working in Rudy Van Gelder's studio, I mean, Van Gelder's pretty famous for not I've always understood, or I've tried to imagine that one of your main roles was kind of to stand in the breach between the artist and Van Gelder, that he doesn't get along with artists quite
That's
as.
Not true.
That's not true.
No.
And so you were in the studio, though, as you said, with the musicians, and Van Gelder was doing the engineering.
Nobody said anything to Van Gelder.
Okay.
There was a joke. I recorded basically every Friday, all right?
Uh-huh.
I had between 1 and 6, or whatever it took, you know, 7, 8, 4, 1 to 4. He never pushed me.
Yeah.
If I got done in 3 hours, he charged me 3 hours. So whatever it was, he was there from 1 o'clock Friday on. And then, like, Friday morning, I'd call him. He wanted me to call him. He says, "What do you got today, Bob?" I said, "Well, Miles is coming with Coltrane, Red Garland, Paul Chambers, Philly Joe." Okay, that's it. The microphones be right there.
Yeah.
Right? Then the guys would come in, like Miles. They didn't say a word. Hi, you know, they say, "Hi, Rudy." Then the next thing they say, somebody would say, "Ready, Rudy?" And they go in their place and they start playing.
So you never had to worry about
never.
Microphone placement, any
never.
Of that kind
no,
of stuff?
No, they'd always say, "Roll him, Rudy. Ready, Rudy." And he'd always be ready, you know.
Now then, would you listen with him and the artist to playbacks, or was
no.
that usually just you?
No, we didn't ever care what he was doing, and the great musicians like Miles, Rollins, Coltrane, Gene Ammons, they didn't want to hear playbacks.
So they like on Saxophone Colossus, they
yeah,
didn't hear
you know,
playbacks?
Sonny never cared. Miles established it. You know, the word got around in the beginning, I think on the Musings of Miles, that was one of the first things I did with him and Rudy. Miles said, "Is that okay, Bob?" It's at the end of one of the tunes. And I said, "Yeah, next." You know, so the word got around that they just go and play, and if I didn't like it, I'd say, "We'll do it again." But otherwise, they didn't bother. They didn't listen. They didn't care. They knew it was good. If I felt it was good, it was good.
Yeah.
And they relied on me to say if I want to do it again, and we did very few second takes, you know, very few.
Right. Now I understand when Coltrane left you that Neshuy Erdogan bought him a Cadillac, and what did he do, woo him away?
Well, I don't know. If it, I
mean, you were almost became like a farm team then, almost,
yeah,
for these
me
majors,
and
Bruno, right?
Bruno were a farm team. Yeah. See, Norman Granz, he was pretty decent. He just utilized the people that he utilized in his Jazz at the Philharmonic, or, you know, the swing type players, or, you know, like when Bud Powell was ill, and Billie Holiday, he backed them by keep recording them, you know, because they were big names one time. That was sort of his rule of thumb. Big time, big names at one time.
Right.
And he'd sell them, I give him credit. Even though the Bud Powells and Billies weren't the greatest, and all of the Dizzys were pretty bad, you know, considering how great Dizzy was.
Yeah.
But he kept recording them, you know, and then when he ran out of those, he kept the thing going with, Zoot Sims did a lot of stuff, Lockjaw Davis.
Right.
You know, so I give the man tremendous credit, you know. That was his rule of thumb. Big time, big names at one time, you know. Were great players, you know, sort of fading in the limelight, but then he recorded the shit out of him. But to me, Neshuy Erdogan, and I don't know if Armin had anything to do, to me, he was like a fucking snake in the grass. Mm. You know, I detest the man, I detest the whole Atlantic bullshit with their public relations. I detest all of that crap. I don't care losing an artist. Sometimes I had an artist, a Blue Note Tango, I take a Blue Note artist. That's fair in war, you know.
Yeah.
But that guy, if you look at the Atlantic catalog, I think one artist, Tony Fusella, you could say is an unknown
mm-hmm.
or a lesser known, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The rest, they took from everybody else.
Yeah. Ornette came from Les Koenig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You go down that catalog.
Right.
You know, and Monk was even there, Mose Allison. On Jazz Quartet, Coltrane, you know, go down the list.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Thiel was another one with the Impulse. He wasn't as bad, but he was pretty, you know, bad too.
that was ABC Paramount money,
yeah,
right?
Right.
So, in fact, the deal with ABC Paramount, Paramount's famous, you know, for that monopoly, or for the Congress declared Paramount monopolistic, where they had what was called vertical integration. They owned their company, they owned the distribution network,
right.
They owned the theaters. And so what you're telling me is the same thing virtually worked with music.
Yeah.
These companies owned everything.
Yeah, now Atlantic became part of Warner Brothers, but see, to me, all right, even if he did all of this, fine, you could say, well, he did pretty good. He gave musicians a lot of money, you know, they didn't make that much money. But in the end, they make the money because the royalties, in the end, even everything out.
Yeah.
Coltrane, his estate, Lounge now, they're getting tons of royalties from me, Blue Note, whatever, you know.
Right.
So it's not so much money, but it's just he waited like a vulture, you know, and waved the money at the time at these people.
Was that the same thing with Columbia and Miles?
Well, Columbia wasn't as bad because Columbia, they did one thing better, is they really promoted an artist.
Yeah.
You know, but even that, it wasn't good either. And that was a rotten thing what happened with me and Miles. And I'll say it because it's the truth. I used to press my records at Columbia, at CBS, in their custom pressing division. In the Miles was with me in the early 50s, I guess, mid-50s.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw damn well, and I got feedback from people that worked in the custom, how well Miles is selling, you know? So they knew goddamn well how Miles was selling for me, and they knew goddamn well how much to offer to get him away and what to wave in front of him.
Because they had the inside track
they,
by
they
sending
had the inside.
You.
They wouldn't be such big shots, same with Atlantic, if they didn't know or surmise. Ertegun could surmise because he had the same distributors at the time as me.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know? So I don't, that's water under the bridge. Screw them because, in a way, it didn't matter because my biggest sellers were Gene Ammons, Etta Jones, Groove Holmes with Misty, Charlie Orland with More Today Than Yesterday, and a few other records that were big smash sellers that weren't in that jazz idiom, you know.
Well, that's real interesting, too, because you had one of the few labels that continued selling to black people as well as white people.
That's right.
I mean, what happened with so much jazz is it just basically started selling to... Well, like you and me, I mean, to white people that were really into the music.
Right. But it was a black music. See,
yeah.
People didn't realize it. I knew that because, see, I started, like I said, as a jazz fan. I know when I was young, before I was in the business, I went out to Brooklyn once and heard Dizzy Gillespie's big band and Lester Young's quintet, and I saw 5,000 black people there. And me and my friend were the only white people.
Yeah.
I saw in Chicago Dizzy play where you didn't see a white person for a group with Milt Jackson, Sonny Rollins, and Dizzy Gillespie. You didn't see a white person. I went in Philadelphia. So these are some of the things that happened. Horace Silver, you know, I go in there, Horace walks right by me, he turns around, Bob, what are you doing here? You know, it was a club, black club. And I said, well, man, I came to hear you play. I'm in town. Oh, great, man, great. He goes up, he makes an out. In the audience is one of my favorite recording people. I've done a lot of sides with him, and side man, Bob Weinstein. Take a bow. Stand up. I get up, man. I'm the only white person. Everybody's looking at me. You know? So I don't care. You know, God's with me because I didn't do nothing wrong, so God's with me. You know?
Yeah.
So I get up and take a bow. You know? Do you know after the set, Horace couldn't get over me. All the people were in line to shake my hand.
How about that?
And they said, man, I dug your sing with the MJQ. I dug Sonny. I dug this. I'm a monk, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, thank you. But I knew all along that there's even Getz was bought by the black people. The black people were always the bulk of the audience.
Yeah.
You know? It was their music, basically, you know?
Now, when Miles did Walking, did... In a session before that, did you and Miles sit down and say, and both of you say, look, we need to take a new direction from this basic kind of real straight bebop sort of thing. We need to play a bluesier kind of deal.
Right, that's why we got Horace. nobody funkier than Horace Silver.
Yeah.
And that's why they got Lucky. And nobody can play tenor, you know, like Lucky, man. He can play, you know, without being corny, he can play funky. And Kenny Clarke, I think, was there. And we had J.J., who played, you know, J.J.'s a pretty funky guy, too.
Right.
And that's the direction we chose. And we got in the studio. And, you know, that's how me and Miles work great, you know. We make up our mind what we want, you know. And that's what we wanted. And we got it, man. To me, Walk is one of my best records.
Oh, it's a great record.
Yeah, and we got the mood, we got the soul.
Right.
And it was a monster seller. And, you know, and another thing we did, talking about that type of thing, spontaneous, it was the Christmas when we did Bags Groove, Modern Jazz Giants, Miles.
Yep.
Well, everybody was down. Nobody had money. Miles, man, I need money. It's Christmas, my kid. Monk's calling me on the phone. Man, I need money, my kid, you know. I think T.S. Monk was his kid at that time.
Right, right.
Yeah, that was his kid.
He had a daughter, too, who died young. I don't know. I don't think she was a little younger than T.S. Monk.
Well, yeah. I always saw T.S. coming down into my office with Monk. You bring him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that kid. He had a baseball cap and a baseball, like a Mets jacket, you know.
Yeah.
He was always with Monk, you know. And Monk's calling, I need money, man. It's Christmas. And then I got a call from Bags, who always had money because they worked. He said, man, I need some bread. So I said, oh, well, I'll get Miles and we'll work something out. He said, listen, Miles, why don't we have a good all-star session, you know? And I want to use you and Monk and Bags. Bags and Monk play good together, you know. They made a lot of good records. And he said, well, I don't know. I said, don't worry, Miles. It's going to be good. You know, if it's no good, we won't do it, all right? He said, okay, we'll do it. And I said, just simple tunes, you know. You just play and let Monk play and Bags. Everybody play, you know. He said, okay, yeah, it should be good. And everybody thought when Monk laid out on Miles, right, Miles said he's going to beat Monk up. You know?
Yeah.
If he played, no, he just didn't want Monk on that tune. Mm-hmm. You know, he wanted that effect, you know, like without the piano.
Yeah.
And Monk, no hard feeling. Those type people loved each other, man. They never fight. And everybody made a big deal. And besides, Miles is tough. But people don't know Monk was like a very strong person. Monk could just push him with one hand and kill him, you know.
Yeah.
But these guys loved each other. See, people don't understand. You know, it's like great baseball players. The All-Stars are playing now this week.
Yeah.
They love each other, man, because of their abilities, you know.
Right.
Or you get these great basketball players, even though they're playing against each other. Oh, man, Shaq loves this one, that one. Yeah, they all love each other, you know.
Now, did Nika come in to those sessions? Did you know about her? Okay, yeah. I wondered what your opinion was about
that
situation.
I don't know. She was like a hanger-on. There was always hanger-on.
Right. She was a wealthy woman, though, right? She
yeah,
was,
yeah. Supposedly. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know.
From the Rothschild family.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Now, when did you did you do any editing of tapes? I know that Alfred Lion did very little, but there would be, you know, if you had a bad ending or something, on one cut, he might add in an ending.
No, what we did very rarely, maybe once or twice. If it wasn't good, Rudy had his orders. I said, we're going to do it again. Rudy would rewind and erase everything. I didn't want to keep takes.
So you didn't do any inserts?
If we did, it may have been very few. I can't remember. If we did, of all the recordings we did, I don't think we did more than three or four endings splicing together.
Yeah.
Rudy, if we had to do that, Rudy, I think we did maybe three or four. Now that I think about it, Rudy would say, take it from so-and-so, and then he'd say, go, and they'd do it, and he was in charge of it. I never did anything.
You recall when that was?
No.
Yeah.
It was in the old studio in Hackensack.
Yeah. Now, one of the things with those recordings is they sound like, I mean, you know, the way that stereo or a mono, well, any kind of recording, whether stereo or mono, it creates the effect that you know, when we're listening to it in our living rooms, that it was recorded in a room, and the the rooms with your recording sounds like it could have been a club. I mean, there's not a lot of reverb. There's not a lot. It's not a big room. It's a smaller kind of club room. Was that an effect that was intentional, or did that just kind of happen?
No, that was Rudy's style.
Uh-huh.
He chose it. I didn't give a shit, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I'll tell you how I met Rudy. I knew of his work from Blue Note, right? Because I always would buy, even when I had my own business, I'd always buy Blue Note records, you know? Because I loved them, you know, they were great jazz. And then I kept seeing Van Gelder, you know, recording. Then one day in the town I lived, Teaneck, New Jersey, I was walking down the main street, and I said, optometrist, Dr. Rudolph Van Gelder. And I went in there, and he wasn't busy, and I asked, you know, to see him. He came out, and I said, you the Rudy Van Gelder that's recording Blue Note? He says, yeah. And I said, oh, I'm Bob Weinstocker. I'm happy to meet you, you know. He said, oh, come in. I know all about Prestige, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I said, yeah, well, I know about you. I've been listening to your stuff for about 6, 8 months, maybe a year. And I was talking to him, and I said, well, you know, how do you do it? You know, what do you do? It sounds different, sounds better. He said, well, I have my techniques, I don't discuss it. Well, you know, it's there on the Blue Notes. If you hear it and you like it, fine, you know. I said, well, are you under contract to Blue Note? He said, no, I can record anybody. So I said, can I do something with you? He said, sure, it was 1954. And, yeah, call me, we set up a session. So I got Miles to record with him first, you know, because Miles had a nice sound and everything. And we did it, and I just went in there, and he took over, you know. I didn't say a word. He said, Miles, here, go here, there, you know, blah, blah. And they recorded, and I listened to the playback, and it sounded great. And that was the sound he had then, and he continued with that sound.
Yeah.
That was you could hear the drums, the bass, you can hear everything. And it sort of sounded like an echo, but it wasn't a deliberate echo chamber. He just added dimension to the recording. That's what his style was.
Uh-huh.
It was to give it dimension, you know, broaden it out or something. That's my way. But when I really knew how great he was, I'll tell you an example. Not to knock Phil Woods. I once did I was the first one to record Phil Woods. He came to the New York area, and I put him under contract, and I brought him out to the studio and did a quartet, I think, the first session. And he sounded so great, you know. I heard him in a club in New York, and, you know, I signed him a contract, and then I got him in the studio. He sounds like a different person, you know. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, then I couldn't still believe it, so I went back to the club after we did the recording. And sure enough, it was the same, not as good as Rudy got him, you know? And then I knew that whatever Rudy was doing was right, because it didn't detract from, it didn't change the words, it just enhanced them, you know?
Yeah.
It was Phil Woods, but he enhanced the sound.
Did you ever?
Phil Woods has a powerful sound.
Right.
You know, but it just sounded so much better, clearer.
Did you ever figure out how he accomplished that?
I didn't care.
You didn't care, yeah.
I didn't give a shit, really.
Right, right.
To me, it was a load off my mind that I didn't have to worry about that, because before, I used to get aggravated trying to do a session. I have to waste half the time trying to get a balance.
Yeah.
You know, and I waste time. It was not only a waste of time, it's just frustrating, you know.
Now, you were not interested ever, I don't guess. I'm curious whether you're a fan of it, but in, let's say, those productions like Milt Gabler would do at Decca, where they were really produced.
No.
Yeah.
No, to this day, I don't. Like, what I'm doing now, the way I work now, is a lot of times I work similar. After I stopped recording, going to the studio, mm-hmm. It didn't matter, because I'd meet with the recording director, say Esmond Edwards was the first one after I quit, you know, and we'd sit and have a meeting, we'd talk, and I'd be very involved in what we're going to do, the musicians, the songs, and everything. It was like I was going to be there, but I wasn't, and fortunately, Esmond Edwards could recording more, so I couldn't handle it all, you know? So he had his function, he'd bring in stuff, we'd have all these different labels that he did, like Bluesville, Bluesville, so on, and we'd talk. He'd say, well, we can get to Bluesville, Lightning Hopkins. And, yeah, grab him, man, Lightning's greatest, you know? See, he'd be like out in the fields, you know?
He was your A&R man.
Yeah, he's my A&R man. Mm-hmm. And then he said, well, what do you want to do with Lightning? I said, okay, here, you know, this is the typical thing. I said, now we just bought this Ampex recorder. I said, go down to Philadelphia, he's playing in a folk club. Record him playing in Philadelphia live. That didn't go off with his tape machine that I bought, the Ampex.
Yeah.
You know, then he'd come back, well, what else do you want on Bluesville? I hear Brian McGee and Sonny Terry's going to the same club. He said, okay, and he'd go down there, you know? Then he'd say, well, Johnny Griffin and Lockjaw got a good group with Junior Mance and so on and so on, Larry Ridley, whatever. And I'd say, yeah, that sounds good. And I knew Lock, and I speak to Lock. You know, I wouldn't be totally out of it. I'd be very involved. I'd call Lock. What do you think if I send Esmond down with the tape machine with your mind? We record a lot of stuff and pick some stuff, and as we use it, we'll pay you. And he says, okay, I'll talk to Griff, and he says, okay, come on down. So Griffin says, sure, why not? So he go down and record Mittens live, and they were great set size, you know. So I was involved. I was even involved in folk music. I went up, because see, I can grasp music. I understood folk music from Woody Guthrie and blues. It was all within my realm of what I like, you know.
You know somebody I really love that's, I don't think, nearly as admired as he should be now, and I'd love to hear about your sessions with him, is Pee Wee Russell.
Oh, he was the greatest. Pee Wee Russell, he could play with anybody, you know, but people didn't realize that. See, we were the first one on the Swingville label to take Pee Wee and put him with Buck Clayton, you know?
Yeah.
A swing trumpet with a Dixieland and let him just play swing. We did it with Bud Freeman, who was another one like Pee Wee, a great player. We put him with Shorty Baker, you know, regular, you know, swing, Carrington type of. That's what we were doing on Swingville. We were putting in modern rhythm sections, O.C. Johnson's, you know, George DeVivier, Ray Bryant. You know, we were mixing these people up.
Yeah,
and
really interesting.
And they were good players, you know, so they could do it.
Yeah, interesting combinations.
So. Yeah, but see, I was, you know, did a lot of the guys that worked for me, Ozzy Cadena, you know, Esmond Edwards, Cal Rampling, Schlitten, Bob Porter, they knew how I thought, and I knew how they thought, and we were great together, you know, and it really helped enhance prestige by having people doing this and leaving me free for projects, research. Like when I went into folk music, I went up and spent time listening to these clubs around Harvard, and I saw there was a whole movement of white folk blues singers, and I developed a whole line. I got a good producer who did the Doors and other stuff later, but Paul Rothschild. But I could work with Paul, but I knew, man, and I hung out in Greenwich Village, so I knew about this music, you know?
Yeah.
So I said, Paul, we're going to do a whole series on Boston folk. He said, yeah, that's great. Man, those things sold. You wouldn't believe what they sold. And I had some good artists that went on, like Tom Rush and Rick Von Schmidt, you know, and Maria Muldaur. You know,
mm-hmm.
But I knew what I was doing, man, because I'm listening, always listening. I used to go in the village, talk to Bob, what you call him?
Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan, by the hour.
Yeah.
Days and hours with Bob Dylan. We talk about blues and this and that. Woody Guthrie, once he found out I knew about Woody Guthrie and all those blues singers, and Lemon Jefferson, you know, he was my man. He wanted begged me to record, and I was an asshole. I didn't. I recorded Ramblin' Jack Elliott instead of him.
Yeah. Yeah,
but all right, we can't win them all.
Everybody's got to have one or two bad
calls.
Yeah,
right. I turned down Jimmy Smith too.
Now these other producers that worked with you, Ozzy Cadena and Esmond Edwards and Bob Porter, were their philosophies of recording were pretty similar to yours.
Yeah.
Did Cadena work at Savoy before he came to you?
Yeah, before. See, and I liked his work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when Esmond left me to go to Chicago to Chess. I immediately called Ozzy because I loved Ozzy's work because he's a swinger, you know.
Yeah.
And then Ozzy, I don't know what happened with him, but I kept him and he did a lot of blues for me. Cal Lampley, he did a lot of good. He was a musician.
He worked at Columbia, right?
Yeah, he worked at Columbia. He was a musician, and he was a black guy also, like Esmond. And he knew what I was doing. He produced Misty was a big hit, very big. You know, they all had their hits, these guys, for me, you know. Mm-hmm. And then Porter was my protege. Schlitten was my buddy for many years. We used to go to the clubs when we were young. And he was the art director, but he was a real jazzer. But he produced a lot of funky albums for me, with Illinois and stuff, Groove Holmes. You know, he did a lot of funky stuff besides the real manja. But Porter was my protege. He came to me when he was a high school kid. And we met in Sam Goody's on 50 or 49th Street. He said, "Man, I got to work for you when I get out of school. Go to college first, man." So he went to Whittier College where Nixon went.
Yeah.
And then he came, "Man, I'm done with college. Like you said, I want to work for you." I said, no, not now. I got other people working, you know. Not now. He says, "Well, if you're not going to hire me, I'm joining the Army." So he joined the Army. They sent him to Alaska. So finally he gets out of the Army, and he goes to L.A. area, and he gets a job with Aetna Life doing some work. You know, he's a brilliant guy. You know, research, I don't know, numbers, whatever. So finally, I said to Schlitten, "Listen, something, I don't know, Cal Lampley, he don't have it anymore, you know, this and that, I don't know. He's too white now, man, you know. So, you know, he's black, he's sort of tended to white, you know. He's too white, he's not doing it right, you know." So he said, Schlitten says, "Well, I keep writing to this guy Porter, your friend, your protege." I said, and he keeps saying, "Man, whatever you want me, I'm ready, man." See, and Porter's funk, man.
Yeah.
Porter, well, you know, like Schlitten knows real jazz, but he can do funk, and vice versa. Porter's funk, but he can do real jazz, too. So I said to Schlitten, "Okay, just tell Porter we're ready. Tell him to come here." Man, Porter came like a bolt of lightning. You know, and we produced a lot of new artists like Houston Persons and all in the funk idiom, you know.
Right.
And we had a lot of great sellers and things were moving good. And that's when the business and the industry went bad. And I said, "I got to get out. You know, I can't stay here. I got three kids and, you know, my wife's spoiled Jewish goddess, you know."
Yeah.
"I can't let her down.
Yeah.
Bankrupt, you know."
So Schlitten then ended up with Joe Fields. And
yeah, they went together, and then they split up, and Schlitten had Xanadu.
Right, yeah. Well, this is really helpful because I'd not made that real connection between that kind of soul jazz sound that Muse would do.
Yeah.
And then how it started at Prestige, and part of the connection there is Schlitten then.
Yeah,
who
right.
Who then gets in that big fight with Joe Fields, right?
Yeah, well, Schlitten is a very hard person to get along with. He's very intelligent. He's a brilliant person when it comes to jazz. He understands a lot of psychology of life. He's basically a very honest, straight-ahead person. He's never going to screw anybody. And if you treat him good, like I did, he worked for me very many years. I never watched him. He was like Rudy. He worked in his house, in his apartment in the Bronx. He knew all the covers when we needed him. He assigned all the liner notes. He did everything, you know, in production. And then he did recording because he loved it as a hobby. I treat him very good. And that's, you know, the type of person he is. Now, Joe Fields, you know, he's a salesman. He was my sales manager for a while. They're different type people.
Yeah.
You know, so there had to be friction, you know. And there was, I guess. I don't know what happened, but I know the way Schlitten is. It's very hard. It's like certain athletes. Only certain coaches can work with certain athletes.
Right.
So only certain people can work with a Don Schlitten, really. You know, and I guess it just didn't work. Theoretically, it should have. The creative with the sales, you know.
Now, with Esmond Edwards, there weren't many black producers, right?
He was the first. Yeah, I was, I'm very liberal. I hate racism. I hate injustice of any kind, whether it's to animals, people, or whatever. And that's my nature. I was brought up that way. I brought my children up there that way. And I'm an underdog type person. When I watch a ball game, like recently in the Stanley Cup Finals, the Red Wings are playing the Devils, I root for the Devils. The Red Wings supposedly have the best team by far. And when Esmond how he came to me was the musicians had a problem getting to New Jersey all the time. And I didn't want to, when I was in New York, it was all right, I'd bring him. Then I moved to New Jersey. I didn't want to go get him and bring him back. Four trips, you know. So the musicians suggested Esmond Edwards. Art Taylor, the drummer, said, my very close friend. He's a photographer on the New York Times. He's an X-ray technician, a very fine person, intelligent. He didn't have to say black, white. That didn't matter to me.
Right.
I didn't care. And I suggest he knows everybody, loves jazz. He could pick us all up, bring us and take us home, and he can hang around and take pictures. You know, you can use them on your covers. And I said, well, I use my own pictures, but if it's part of the job, it's a relief to have somebody round up you guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Fine, I'll let him do the pictures. I don't care, you know. So that's how it started. He did that for a year. And then in between waiting to take him home, he'd watch and listen, you know, and he'd see how it was going on and everything. So one day I went to him and I said, Esmond, I want you to start keeping time and this and that and watch what I do. So maybe I'll work it out. I'm getting too busy and everybody likes you and everything. And I said, just, you know, one day you might get the stopwatch and I'll leave, you know?
Yeah.
So he said, oh, yeah, I love that, you know. So one day I said to him, Esmond, we're doing a session with Eddie Lockjaw Davis, the cookbook, and with Shirley Scott, the organ. And he said, oh, yeah, I know Lockjaw. I see him a lot in town, yeah. Well, I said, that's good that you know him. So I said, why don't you run the session? And I'll be there, you know. So he did, and it came out good. And I showed him how to take ordinary material and make a hit. I said, now look, see this blues? It's kind of funky. He said, yeah, that's right. He knew what I was talking about. Well, I'm going to make this blues in the kitchen to feature the whole album. And I said, I'll show you how. And I went out, said, well, Rock, let's see. We're running about 5 minutes of tune. Why don't you play in the kitchen for about 8 minutes and stretch out and let Shirley stretch out and be real funky. And he said, okay, I got it. You know, he did it. He said, see, you got to just learn what to feature in each album, you know, can't always figure in advance. You don't know what the musicians are going to do, you know.
Yeah.
So once you figure it out, then you go for it, you know.
I got you, yeah.
And that's how we do, pick our strong tracks and make the album sell better.
Mm-hmm.
So he did very well for me. And, you know, he went along. I threw a big party in my house with my kids were up to be there special, the little kids, and invited all kinds of music people, blacks, whites, you know. And, you know, we celebrated his being. I appointed him a vice president right off the bat because it was a responsibility, you know.
Yeah.
And he was the first officer that was black in a white company. I'm sure
mm-hmm.
some of the black companies had black laws. And he was a very nice guy, and he was with me, I don't know how many years. And one day, he made a big seller, and it's like the old Atlantic story over again. He says, Bob, I'm got a big offer from Chess Chicago, and I'm gonna be leaving.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, you know, I don't give a shit, man. Because
mm-hmm.
as good as he was, I felt I'm better, man. I could always go do it.
Yeah.
And I had Ozzy in mind anyway. I always loved Ozzy, you know.
Right.
And then, sure enough, I was right. So Esmond leaves, and then Ozzy's in my, I could see it like yesterday. Ozzy's in my arm. Well, Bob, what are we gonna do to start this off? I said, well, Gene Ammons is coming into town. And we got this bossa nova stuff with Getz going. Why don't we do a Gene Ammons bossa nova album? He says, that's a great idea. So we cut an album, bad bossa nova, it's bad, you know, good.
Mm-hmm.
And we do this thing, Caporange Jungle Soul, and the thing turns out to be a hit, a smash album, you know. And that was Ozzy's first one, you know. We worked it out together.
Yeah.
And I could call up Ozzy in the middle of the night, Ozzy, you know, I want to do some blowing albums. We need some releases. He said, well, I'll get Herbie Mann. I can get that. Okay, get Herbie. Let's do him a little on the funky side. You know, you do all this pretty stuff. What else you got? He said, well, I'll get this, that. He said, okay, fine, great. Bam, bam. You know, we do it.
Yeah. Well, some of these people you worked with, I mean, Getz is one case, Monk is another, are pretty famous for being cantankerous in different ways. Were there moments where...
Never.
Never with you.
No, I never had a problem with an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Because, first of all the black musicians, even in the worst racial strife, you know, when they're burning Newark and Detroit and L.A., burning New York down, and they'd come to the sessions, they look at me and I look at them, and then there'd be like a silence, you know, nobody knew what to say because it was terrible times with the blacks and whites, you know, and then a few of them, as they came in, they'd hug me, say, brother, you know, and I said, you're goddamn right, brother, I feel for you people because the shit that's been going down all these years, you know, no wonder is what's happening, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, they knew where I was coming from, they respected my musical thing, they respected my taking artists and reviving certain artists, like, you know, Miles is one of the nicest things he said about anybody, is that I record him when nobody cared for him, you know.
Right.
And they just respected me. I never had any shit, and I never did anything that wasn't, everything I did, I treated everybody like human beings, man.
Yeah.
And that's how I treat anybody. I talked to Cubans. I came and talked to English here in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I treat my human beings.
Yeah.
I pray to God twice a day to be a good person and help people.
Yeah.
I've always believed that my whole life. You know.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for what God has given me. You know, God gave me an ability to love jazz and be in the business and do these things. And God gave me good health. You know, nobody's perfect. You always something wrong, little. But thank God, I've never had anything that wasn't too, you know, I've never had any major problems. I'm big, I'm strong, I'm athletic, I'm tough. You know, I'm good with people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't be anything but else but grateful and thankful. And when you're that way, you've got to feel for people, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got women where I live, old ladies that lose their husbands. They come over, they cry and miss me and hug me. Say, no, I feel for them.
Right.
And I tell them things, nice things about that I saw in their lives. And they don't even realize that I was watching their lives, you know.
Yeah.
But that's the way I am. I'm very analytical. I'm well-read. I watch thousands of movies every year.
Yeah.
And I believe that we're here to help people.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Well, listen, I really appreciate you talking to me. It's been wonderful. Quite an education.
Well, okay.
Let me get your address so that when this article comes out, I can send you a copy of it.
Where is it going to come?
It'll come out of Tower Records Magazine, Pulse, and it'll also...
Oh, that's the record store?
Yeah, that's a big record store. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I heard of Tower.
Yeah, and...
You wouldn't believe this, but Ralph Caffel, the head of Fantasy Now, when he was a distributor, he was the first one to really put out tons of records in the Tower stores in
right.
California.
Right, Russ. Well, in fact, the first Tower stores were in California.
Yeah.
In Sacramento, I believe it started. Russ.
Well, when he'd have an album, he believed in, like a Mose Allison, that he thought would go beyond jazz. He put hundreds in the Tower stores.
Well, one of the things Tower did, too, that no other stores were doing at the time they started was they were an inventory store like Borders or Barnes & Noble.
Right.
They would stock everything that
was
in the catalog.
Yeah.
So they didn't care whether they could sell, millions of Madonna records and very few Lightning Hopkins. They would stock both of them.
Yeah, I know. He always would tell me that. But anyway, one thing I want to add, I'm telling a lot of the past, but I've evolved this new philosophy of recording now, of producing, since I've gone back.
Right.
I told you I did four and I'm going to do eight. But actually, the way I do it now, I learned very fast that the way I used to record is not very conducive to the newer jazz artists.
Oh.
It's very alien to them to go in and just play and this and that, you know. The newer artists has to, they rely more on, they rely more on working things out than not working.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They come in, they want to be more prepared, and they're more interested, rather than just blowing like the old musicians I used to do, they're more interested in producing sounds and, it's very hard for me to explain. In other words, have a better way to say it. They take more control of their destiny than the old musicians did. In other words, they pick their players who they record with very carefully, and they record at studios they want to record, and they're very careful to pick their studios and their musicians, their fellow musicians. They go more for picking their material than the other musicians. And I noticed this very fast when I did Billy Ross sort of the old way, but I noticed that he was, even though I did it the old way, I saw he was prepared to do it more his way, you know? But it ended up we did it my way because Billy was new to recording. But then other artists I'm working at, I sort of sit with them and we discuss what we're going to do. They give me an outline of the songs and who they want to record and so on. They tell me about the studio. And then I just set up a budget with the company. And they're producing their own records. But they will call me constantly to ask me questions and tell me what they're doing. And then before we get done with the session, I get a tape. So I want them to, you know, do anything over or overdub. You know, we're getting into more technical stuff.
Yeah, using the studio more.
Yeah, I never did that.
Yeah.
But I saw very quickly that this is the way it is.
Yeah.
And it's my, I'm like the executive producer rather than the producer, and I treat them as they're the Ozzy Cadenas, Bob Porters, and Ezra and Edwards, even though they're the artists.
Yeah.
I'm letting them be the producer.
They're almost self-produced then.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah. They do rely on me, and they thank me, and a lot of times, Milton Mustafa, he's telling me what he's going to do, I said, that's great, you know, fine, and I just acted like, he didn't want me to come, you know. I just, maybe, you know, I just kept my mouth shut. And then he said, well, man, I'd like you to come down and see what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I said, you sure, Milton? You seem to be doing very well without me. I said, we talked about the band and what you could do. We were going to feature soloists and the direction of the CD. I said, Milton, you don't really need me.
Yeah.
I said, we'll get together when you finish the material. See, I build their confidence that way. And, you know, they feel, well, man, you know, I'm doing good, you know. But it's good for these generations of musicians. The others were such great giants and stars that they could play like Al Cohn did by himself, I think it was, America the Beautiful.
Yeah.
And it sounded great.
Right. You know though.